It's a beautiful night. We try to practice 3 to 12 o'clock tonight. But Edmund, you're on a different time zone, so whatever works for you, don't worry. So we welcome Edmund to Tisarna. Nice to have another Latvian person here. I've been fasting, so I was walking down to Andy's place on Pike Lake, and oddly enough, I started to think about food. The beautiful white snow pine trees. I'd like a sausage. Lovely snow glistening off. I'd like some sauerkraut. Now, it's interesting, the food I was thinking about was Latvian food. And that's a kind of, it's the dependent origination is a way of speaking about the way our consciousness works. And you could, you know, one way you could say, I was walking and I was thinking about food because I've been fasting and so on. Not that I don't think about food at other times. But you could also say that with fasting as condition, there is an increased interest of food in the afternoon. With contact with a Latvian person, there is Latvian perception, and then all that together conditions thoughts of sausage and sauerkraut. It's dependent origination, that's how it works, isn't it? And the way we use dependent origination in Buddhism is to replace the sense of ownership or sense of self in the Dhamma formulations, in the Vinaya, or in the discipline of monks and lay people, we have ownership, we have responsibility. We always try to make that clear, that there is that realm of responsibility, that if I speak in unkind ways to something, it's appropriate for me to apologize, because I'm responsible for my speech. And but also that it can be seen that in the flow of consciousness, with certain type of speech, a certain type of mood as condition, there's the arising of a desire to speak. With the attachment to the desire, the speaking comes out. With the speaking coming out, there's a consequence. That consequence is suffering, dependent origination. Right? So we're using both. And dependent origination is a really, it sounds very complicated, but it's a very good one to try to use in the way you perceive yourself. Because the self definitions we have are very limiting if they're based on ignorance. But to put into the mind, oh, well, this has conditioned, that arises, brings you back into awareness, of change, rather than into the self-definitions that we get caught up into. So it's the teaching is actually, I think it's just pointing to one thing all the time, and that's non-grasping. The profundity of non-grasping we realize through long spans of non-grasping, or long periods of being awake to the way things are. So that's what I do. I take that as the home base, as it were. I take that as the center point, or I take that as the point of balance, that the awakened mind, the mind which knows the khandhas as the khandhas, is the goal, and that the sustaining of that goal makes the goal more and more profound. If there could be a way of talking that way, that the goal can be more and more profound in its kind of stationary aspect, you see what I mean? So if you just keep in mind that the whole, for me, when this is the way I operate, the whole point of the practice is to awaken to the way things are. And we can define that as non-grasping of the khandhas, because when you're not grasping the khandhas, you know the way things are. It can be formulated as dependent origination, with this as condition that arises when there's that. Because when you're seeing that, you're seeing flow of consciousness, you're not caught up, you're not attached. Seeing it as anicca dukkha anatta, because when you're noticing change rather than caught up in trying to change things, when you're noticing anatta, when you realize that no condition can satisfy, you're realizing the lakkhana of dukkha, the characteristic of dukkha, that's non-grasping. So there's many ways that the teaching points to this one profound and continual realization, I think. Like it's a continual realization because you're kind of realizing, oh yeah, this is the way it is now. This is the way it is now. Again and again and again until it becomes smooth, constant, and long in duration. And then the rest of the teaching you could see is just the method for that. The method for that to happen, like you take the eight precepts. And so the eight precepts are not they're not a goal, are they? That's not the goal, the eight precepts. They're the method. It's like a ladder. You know, the ladder gets you on the roof. But the goal isn't the ladder. The ladder is to get on the roof, fix the roof, say. So that's the method or the path. Right? It's the method. And you can see that if one stays by the precepts and has a chance to do renunciant precepts, living celibate and living in a non-distracted way, it's actually very calming. It's much less inputs, much less stimulation. And then if you take the whole path, you think about things like generosity is the method, compassion is the method. You take all those together, you can kind of see that the method is being a happy person, which is a kind of, it's not the goal. It's not the goal to be a happy person. It's just the very fact that one functions from sila, samadhi, panya, actually brings the heart to a sense of lightness, to a sense of non-remorse. It gets nourished by generosity and compassion, and all that makes the whole sense of being a human being very light and happy. There's still the heaviness of bodily pain and the kind of conflicts that we have in social institutions and so on. And that's the foundation. That's the foundation for the capacity to sustain this awake mind for long spans of time. So that when we arrive at that, and we arrive at that point of awakening continually through the day, you know, it's not like an arrival that comes at the end of the retreat. It's always available, isn't it? You can always, I'm walking along down the end, he's thinking about food, and then, thinking about food, that's the awakening. Oh, that's just interesting. That's what the mind's thinking about. So the awakening is always available. And if we make that, make it conscious that is the goal. You're there. Now, how can I just stay there? Like, how can I stay home now for longer spans? And that you see, when we all see, it's quite a challenge. It's quite a challenge because obviously what happens is that the attention gets drawn into the khandhas because of desire or largely habit. A lot of it's habit. Sometimes there's extreme things like pain, very difficult. You know, bone pain, very, very difficult not to kind of get averse to that or worry about it. Very hard, very hard. But whatever the challenges are, we take them. There's no choice. There's no real choice. And so if one sees that, okay, that's the thing to get to and then just try to sustain, then what one looks at is, well, what in my makeup, in my character, what is it about the preoccupation with the khandhas? How do I get kidnapped? In what kind of ways do I get preoccupied with the khandhas? And that's our analytical side. You know, our analytical side looks at, well, what am I always thinking about? Or what am I always distracting into? And then if your goal then is to be awakened to the way things are, you begin to figure out for yourself, okay, what can I do to awaken more quickly to that particular kind of obsession my mind gets caught up into? Or what can I do to not just distract myself for long periods of time? Or what can I do to be less excited by things? Or, you know, whatever. There's many ways that we get kind of distracted. None of them are right or wrong. They're just the kind of karmic makeup that we're working with. That's the field we're cultivating in. And so then you have a sense of, because it's not just aware of the way things are, you're also seeing, we all get insights, don't we? Because we're using discernment. We see, oh wow, I'm really critical today. My mind's really, really critical today. Okay, that's an awakening. And you notice it's the critical mind's kind of full blown today for some reason. And then you decide, okay, so what kind of practice could I do to awaken to the arising of the critical mind? What kind of practice could I do to notice the critical mind, to see the end of the critical mind? Not get rid of it, but see how it arises and ceases. Yeah? And that's quite a creative process. It's not a, you're not trying to expunge a particular habit of mind, just seeing that, oh, I'm really preoccupied with criticism here, what can I do? And so from that kind of consideration, one starts to use the Buddha's recommendation on developing skillful perceptions. And that's, I think, one of the really lovely things of the path, is that, you know, because we have intellect and we're intelligent, we can see, not only can we perceive something, but we can actually observe the very act of perceiving. And that's an interesting thing. Not only can I, like say you take the critical mind, not only can I notice that, not only can I be critical of someone, like I can say, oh, that person is too, you know, they're sloppy or something like that, I can also notice myself perceiving someone in that way. And that's the awake mind. That's the awake mind. And that's rather marvelous. Now, the person who doesn't develop the awakening to the way things are has a very hard time with perception, because they tend to believe the perception and get very much kidnapped by all perceptions. But just to you know, so you'd say to some people who are not reflective, they say, you know, have you noticed that you get angry real easy? That's just the way I am. That's just the way I am. A kind of total rejection of any kind of reflective capacity. And so the methods that we have on the path, on like developing perception, say in monastic life, we have that perception of being content with little, santiti, just being, accepting the alms food that we have, the lodging that we have, the clothing that we have, the medicine that we have, the community we're in, and just saying, oh, it's good enough. And that the use of that perception is different than the ideal that I should be content with what I have. The ideal that I should be content with what I have is not a perception, it's a demand. Or it's a judgment, right? Whereas perception, the way perception works is you, like, I just think back to my early days in the wapapong and the offering of food. The food was very, very, very basic, and my conditioned mind of, you know, really good Western food and whenever I wanted it all the time, and so on, did not feel content with the food in my bowl. That was the habitual reaction to the food in the bowl. But how else could it be? You know, I'd come from a rich culture with rich food, and I came into a very basic agrarian culture where they give me the very best they had, but they didn't have much. So what else could I feel but disappointment with the food that was offered? That would be very natural, and that's dependent origination. With this kind of conditioning as a Westerner and living in Western culture, living in urban culture, coming into Northeast Thailand, very basic culture, what else could I have? So that's natural. That's Dhamma. That was the Dhamma of my conditioning. But then if I had taken the position, well, I should be content, which I sometimes did, that's awful. You think about it. How could I feel anything else? But then if I put on top of that a judgment that, you know, you should be content with the food you have, then that would make me really feel awful and frustrated, and it just wouldn't work. So, but a perception that I put in there, I'd noticed that I want something else. Yeah, but the training is to be content with what you have. But the training is to be content with what you have. And that's a very gentle kind of suggestion. That's a very lovely kind of suggestion. The habit force, you know, it's just kind of persistent. And then again, how else could it be if I've... You say, well, how old was I? I was 26, say. 26 years old. Mom fed me well. I traveled around. I could eat whatever I want, right? And then all of a sudden, 26 years of conditioning, any food, any time, very good food, da-da-da, hits this very basic food, which is lovingly given. I was always grateful, actually. I was never ungrateful. But that 26 years of conditioning hits this basic sticky rice and chili, and it's not content. It's like, no, I want something else. And that's the force of desire and the force of habit. And there's nothing wrong with that. But how to train the mind then, I think, and how to train the mind is to see, that we are involved in habit. And these habits are, even though we understand them, they have a persistent power. And that's what we call vipaka kamma, resultant kamma. But it's dependently originated. So if you use dependent origination as a type of perception, that's a perception, isn't it? The perception that, you know, I should be content, is not really a perception, it's a demand, right? But the noticing of disappointment with food, and noticing, oh, that's the perception of disappointment. I can be aware of that. And then I can say to myself, but you don't have to hang on to that. And I can say to myself, no, I'll try to be content with little. And even if it takes 5 years, so be it, right? Even if the force of habit is so very strong, well, fine, just keep doing it. And sure enough, that the old perception, the vipaka kamma, of, in this case, having certain access to types of food and the discontent that came about not having it, that the force of that is no longer fed. And that's intention. Intention is the feeding, or the karma, this is karma, this is the feeding of a certain kind of intentionality. Now I'm no longer feeding it. So the vipaka kamma, the resultant kamma of discontent, starts to fall away. And then I start to feel the resultant kamma of sustaining a perception of, it's good enough. And that begins to dominate consciousness. It has power now. And that makes the mind happy and content. And that's the basis for sustained awareness. It's beautiful. It works really, really nice. Except you have to keep at it for 5, 10, 20 however many years it takes. It takes a kind of persistence. So it's like the Baramese, or those kinds of perceptions are the method. They're the method. Or take something like around metta bhavana, we've been talking about that at breakfast. There's so many ways you can use metta bhavana. It's a really, really rich and beautiful practice. So, like we were talking, reading Ajahn Sumedho's piece on, how did he phrase that? With a welcoming practice that he learned to do, that a lot of us do, or that phrase he uses latterly, it all belongs. That's a way of metta practice, isn't it? Where you if you think about it, that example of my discontent with food, right? If I say it all belongs, that's acceptance. Yeah, that paticca samuppada, it all belongs. It's always conditioned. But then I make an effort to create different kind of perception to give me more sati. So just the fact that I can accept a habit is it all belongs. It's a part of metta bhavana. So it's one way to do it. And then there's the kind of formula way we do it, where we might list a set of formulae. May I be well, may I be free from suffering, be free from anger, free from these kinds of... I haven't memorized those, but those are very good. Those are very good. You get a set of five phrases, and you just repeat them again and again and again and again and again and again. So what does that do? You stabilize the mind with language, and you nourish the heart with kindness. That's the method. It's not the goal. It's not like you're trying to manufacture a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful state of mind that you can sort of really enjoy. That would be a goal, right? Kind of this manufacturing of metta. But you're not, that's not the point of it. The point of it is to give the mind, the heart some nourishment, give it some language where it can stabilize into the present moment so you can be aware. So you can go back to the same thing again. Awareness, awake to the way things are. And a heart which has been nourished with kindness and intellect which is used in a kind of disciplined way, to use language in a disciplined way, creates a kind of foundation of content, ease. And again, it's easier to be aware of the way things are. And especially like if the mind, but let's say the mind has a very, again, let's say it's the mind's very critical, has a strong tendency to be judgmental and critical. And then, you do things like you try to use metta bhavana to create different perceptions. So you might, let's say you find yourself just hypercritical of someone or something, yourself or something else. And then you feel that come up into the mind, dependent origination. With this as condition that arises. But then, so you accept it, it's metta bhavana. Then you might say because you get trapped by that perception, maybe that condition of criticism all the time, you say, okay, so what do I do? I keep getting lost in this, what could I do? Well, then you make a kind of determination. Maybe you say to yourself, well, just as I don't like to be criticized, I will not criticize others. Just as I don't like to be criticized. And you say that each time. Each time you find yourself criticizing, you say, oh, yeah, but just as I don't like to be put down, I will not put others down. And you just keep doing it. You just keep doing it. And that's what we call practice. Practice. But that's... And the goal isn't to be someone who is never critical. That's not it. It's to be awake to the critical mind and not get lost in it, not get attached to it, and use it skillfully. Use it skillfully. But again, if I'm like really highly, like if I've been an editor or something my whole life, or I've really developed a critical mind a lot. And then I start to see, wow, my mind is really preoccupied with criticism all the time. I must spend half the day criticizing myself or others. Well, okay, that's momentum. I got it. Okay, I'm going to work with this. Okay, it might take 20 years or whatever. But what can I do? And I start to put this alternative in. Just as I don't like to be criticized, I will not criticize others. And that's one of the ways that Metta Bhavana is taught, isn't it? You know, it's taught just, you know, that, like, I feel pain. I don't like pain. You don't like pain. I like to be loved. I like to be cared for. You like to be cared for. It's a very beautiful reflection, isn't it? It's very true. And that kind of and that takes skill. That takes, like, skillful thinking. It takes kind of composed thinking, you know, like reflective, contemplative thinking. And just like, so I find myself just being hypocritical towards someone. And I say, well, actually, how would I feel if I was criticized like that? Not nice. I wouldn't want that. So I'll try not to do that to others. And then you do that for 20 years. You just keep, you know, you just little by little, just keep hammering away. And that you can do. That you can do. But to say to yourself, I shouldn't be so critical, I'm not going to be critical, that does not work. Because it's not based on dependent origination. It's based on maybe a good wish, you know, it's a kind of wholesome wish, but it's still based on a kind of critical demand. You know, kind of critical demand that I shouldn't be this way. Like Lompo Sumedho says, a kind of inner tyranny. So we can do that. We can do that kind of thing. I think I mentioned that what I was doing with my mom, I was taking the picture of my mom and then bringing her in. I said, just as mom loves me, I will try to love others. Well, that's very powerful. That's very powerful. And then, you know, then I... You know, then you come up to someone, just as love them, not with that one, no way. No way. And then you feel that, oh, this is a feeling of wanting to push some away. And you just keep practicing, and it's just about awareness, that's all it is. That's all it is. All these practices. And they're not a demand that you love all the time or like all the time or that you're not critical. It's not a demand at all. It's just seeing that the constant preoccupation with the khandhas in all these different ways that we get caught up into prevents that sustaining of awareness, which takes you to the deeper realization of what awareness is about. Free of self, free of greed, hatred, and delusion. And I think if one takes that kind of simple statement that the goal is about awakening, and awakening just in an ordinary way, just knowing, oh, color of the carpet's this way. Right? The sound is this way. Just kind of like, just keep doing that all the time. And that's what you're going to do. Then you'll see what you're preoccupied without. Then you'll develop the ubaya, skillful ubaya for yourself, of what you need to do to sustain awake mind. And that takes care of the doubts. But if you get like caught up into, you know, you have to get something and you're trying to attain something, get very much caught up in self and time and trying to get rid of this moment to create another kind of moment. But awareness is not trying to get rid of this moment. That's the beauty of it. It just knowing this moment. It can be really awful or it can be really beautiful, and it's fine. It goes beyond those polarities, beyond those dualities. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Sadhu.